Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest today is Marion Womack, talking about her novel, The Swimmers. We also hear from lawyer Elizabeth Sneed on her new self-help book about coping with a relationship breakdown. And Lynn Fraser talks about her novel, The Busy Mum's Guide to Getting Away with It. Marion, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, Elizabeth and Lynn, they're Cambridge-based, and I know that you're Cambridge-based as well, but that's not where you started life, is it? You weren't born in this area.
No, I come from the south of Spain, from Andalusia, and in fact, The Swimmers is based in Andalusia. It's the first book I write set in my hometown, really, in Cádiz. And then I came to the UK for my education. I went to Glasgow University, then Oxford, where I met my husband, and then I came to Cambridge.
And what impact has it had on your writing, moving from one environment to another, do you think? Have you become, I mean, setting and location are really very important in The Swimmers. Has it made you aware of those kinds of things?
Well, I've learned to look at things from the outside. And one of the things that I write is weird fiction. Weird fiction, you have to distance yourself and sort of pose a new look on your environment and maybe bring up things that people don't notice. Being an outsider, that's very easy for me to do that. So that's probably why I actually lean towards weird and gothic fiction. But also, funny enough, now I feel like that as well about my hometown, because I haven't been there for so long. I left when I was 21, 22. I'm 46 now, so I've been living away from it longer than I live in it. So that kind of distance allows you to post a certain kind of view, maybe even direct readers' views to things that you think they should be looking at and they're not looking, like climate change in this case, for example.
And the where you grew up, very different to where you're living now. I mean, Cambridgeshire, oh, yes, the Fens, far from the sea, very flat. Andalusia, close to the sea and quite mountainous. What was your reaction to the landscape here?
Well, I'm completely haunted by the Fens. And in fact, the first novel that I wrote in English, The Golden Key, is set in and around the Fens. And it's a fairy, it's a sort of parallel world and fairies. And people kept saying to me, there are no fairies in the Fens. No, it's a very fairy-like landscape where you can imagine that the mist comes rolling and suddenly you are in another world. I remember the first time I went, I was taken by my husband's family to a beach in North Norfolk. I was really in shock. I couldn't see the sea and I was thinking, this is not a beach.
So we'll listen to your first choice of music in just a moment, Marion. Is music important to you?
It's very important for my process, probably because we're a young and growing family at the moment. We're in lockdown. And in order for me to avail myself of being able to do something productive and something creative, I need to find my own headspace. And music is very useful for that.
And this first choice, The Sun is Setting by Trio Medieval. Why this one?
When I started going out with my husband, he's originally from Cambridge, even though we didn't meet here, he took me to see them sing in a little church in the centre of Cambridge, the church next to Davies, the bookshop. And it was one of the first times we went on a date. So I've basically latched on this group as something very important to me, to my imaginary as well.
And that was The Sun is Setting by Trio Medieval, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Marion Womack. Marion's debut short story collection, Lost Objects, published in 2018, was shortlisted for 2 British Science Fiction Association Awards and 1 British Fantasy Award. Her first novel, The Golden Key, was published last year, and her second, The Swimmers, is out this month. Marion, we're going to find out more about The Swimmers, obviously, but I just wanted to talk to you about genre, really, and where you fit in the whole issue of genre, because it's science fiction, it's fantasy. You yourself have described it as gothic and weird. Mm-hmm. What is it? If you had to put a label on it, it sort of slips away from all
goodness.
Of those.
If I have one label, I would call it a speculative fiction. It's simply a way of detach myself from realism. And it's not that I don't like writing realist. In fact, I published a novel in Spain, in Spanish, and it was a realist novel. It's simply that I don't feel the realism is big enough to encompass in the ideas that are worrying me at the moment. I basically gravitated, for example, into environmental themes and climate change fiction and talking about all those topics after I had my first child 9 years ago. Something inside me clicked. And I really thought this was a very, very important theme that I should be addressing as an artist. I mean, I don't want to get all political or all serious, but really I could sense a shift in the kind of stories I wanted to tell. Sometimes if you want really to provoke some impact in the reader, you can't just tell him the reality that he's seeing through his window. You need maybe to find narrative strategies that are going to startle them up in a way. And I certainly feel that gothic fiction and speculative fiction and science fiction can maybe touch those buttons in a way in the reader.
What kind of influences have you got on it? I mean, you mentioned White Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys as being a major influence on you. What others are there and why that one?
White Sargasso Sea is one of my top five favorite books of all times. And Jean Rhys is one of my favorite writers. Even though I hate making lists, if you ask me to give you a list, it will be there, White Sargasso Sea. What really struck me about it from the first time I read it was exactly how impactful it was. And that is connected to many things. One thing is length. It's a novel that you can sit and you can read in an afternoon, and it gives you breathless. And it's a novel that offers you more questions than gives you answers, obviously, because it's the prequel to Jane Eyre, so maybe the answers are going to come later or something, but it makes you think. Certainly, I was incredibly taken by the use of Gothic language within a landscape that wasn't your average Gothic landscape. It was a jungle, a tropical landscape. And I did feel that there was a connection there to speak about Andalusia as well, because Andalusia might not be your obvious Gothic place. It's not a moor with the ruin of an abbey or something, but it's a very, very dark place. So I was trying to find this way of writing something impactful, of using Gothic language, of portraying a place that was claustrophobic because it was luscious, not because of darkness or clouds. And to be honest, The Swimmers started being a short novella. In its first iteration, it was 44,000 words. But I should maybe mention that this is a novel that I wrote for my PhD thesis. And The Golden Key is a novel that I wrote for my master's dissertation. And I did the Cambridge University Creative Writing MSc here in Cambridge and the PhD in Anglia Ruskin. So everything very local. And I wanted to keep it at 44 or 43. I wanted to be a novel that you could sit down like White Sargasso Sea and read in one go in a couple of hours. This wasn't something that my supervisor thought was a very good idea. And my editor also was thinking that maybe I should lean more towards the normal average novel length of 66,000 words. Or I think what I'm trying to say is that at the beginning, the book I had in my head and the first iteration was much closer to that model that I was following.
And do you say Andalusia is dark? What's dark about Andalusia?
Well, perhaps because there's so much light. There's so much that you think everything is in view, but it's a place full of secrets. If I think about my family, a very average, a very normal, everyday Andalusian family. I've got more than 30 first cousins, which is something that my husband thinks is hilarious. But my mom had 8 brothers, and my father also had tons of brothers and sisters. So you put them together, more than 30 first cousins. So we're a very typical Andalusian family. We have the house in the country where we go and we plant things and we have animals. And then we live in towns around Seville and Cádiz. And I had a very normal Andalusian upbringing. But if you actually scrub the surface and look through the cracks, there's a lot of secrets. There's a lot of things going on in my family. And in fact, I started writing in English because one day I wanted to write a about them. And I kept thinking, I can't write about them in Spanish. No one is going to speak to me anymore. I have to, you know, if I really want to tell the stories that they have. Yes, it's full of secrets and of very dark secrets. And this is not apparent precisely because it's such a, it's a place superficially so full of light.
Well, let's talk about The Swimmers then. So for people who haven't read it, what's it about?
It's about a certain kind of colonialism. It's about how people who are far away from where you live can influence where you live. It's about the power relations that emerge between different castes, different classes of people. It's about how the world could turn like this when resources are scarce. And well, this is the world that I've imagined in the future. When some people can put themselves out of harm's way by, for example, exiting the earth, and some people are left behind. So it's about that kind of inequality that is already here in a way, it's already in our world. And I think COVID is showing that that kind of inequality is already at our doorstep. But what you can do with a speculative fiction, and I was talking before about impact, is to magnify this message. And no, we're talking about a world in which people can live outside in a space and be safe. So you can actually magnify this inequality to make it more obvious to the reader. But hopefully they will make the connection to the world now. My husband and me, we met at Oxford where we were students, and then we decided to go back to Spain to live and raise a family there. And the reason why we went to Spain is because my memory of living in Spain was of a place where there wasn't that much class going on, as it were. People from working class backgrounds could have a very good education and very good sanity. And there wasn't like a very big gap between the rich and the poor. And after 7-8 years in Spain, we realized first that was a dream and a memory I had from when I was little that wasn't then like that anymore. And second, that had changed massively. So in Spain, for example, now the difference between the rich and the poor is massive. Cambridge is a place where that also happens. So yes, it really is about that inequality, and it's putting a lens on it.
And the plot revolves around, well, there's a society in the air and living above the earth, and then there's a society sort of living in a jungle landscape, and the relationship between the two. And it's a very frightening world. It's a world where nature is kind of fighting back and encroaching on the land and quite dangerous. When you building a world like that, where did you start? Because world building in this genre is so important, isn't it? It has to feel real and be consistent.
I do have my own opinion about world building, and that's maybe why I call myself a speculative fiction writer and not a science fiction writer. I like a lot, for example, M. John Harrison's definition of world building, and he's an amazing author, one of my favorite authors. And he says, I don't need to read the instructions booklet of the Enterprise. It's not a washing machine. And that resonates with me so clearly. I'm so interested in creating an emotional impact in the reader that I, for example, don't really care if the science doesn't exactly add up. If somebody comes to me and says, oh, a hare could not evolve in the way that you describe in this monstrous animal, there's no reason for this, this could not happen in 200 years. I don't care, because I want to have a scene in which a monstrous hare tries to attack Pearl, the protagonist of the book, because I'm looking for a different kind of reaction in the reader. And I know I'm mentioning the word impact a lot, but that's really what I'm after. I'm after creating an emotional response. And the world that I create, the world building, is a tool for that.
It makes for a disturbing read, because we don't quite know what's going to happen because of that unpredictability. And yet there are things that we can recognise. There is a sea full of plastic. There is a jungle that is fighting back after being destroyed. The environmental message is clear. That is something that you wanted to research and get across.
Absolutely. I think that's basically one of the main themes of the novel. Well, it's not a theme, really. It's something that is there because it has to be there. If I imagine the future, I imagine it like that, after environmental collapse. So to me, it's a no given. I am now, for example, writing a novel that feels closer to our day to day. And I was, in fact, debating whether to put COVID or not in it. And it's not that I'm putting COVID, but certainly I can't escape the reality that our life is as it is. So I'm very, very careful of the kind of interactions that the characters have, because I don't want to hide COVID. You know, it's part of our life now. and our life is so strange now. And I'm not going to address it, but it's going to be there in the way things happened. I think if you write about the future, you can't escape climate catastrophe. If you're writing about the future and you are not mentioning that, you're just deluding yourself, in my opinion.
And there are classes within the society and the culture still, people who are chosen for a life either in space or even on Earth. There are different kind of castes, if you like.
This is how it's going to be. And in a way, like we were saying before, this is how I think is already things are shaping themselves. I remember one day they asked me in an interview, where do you find inspiration for speculative fiction and dystopia stories? And I said, The Guardian. So, no, I read, for example, once about biggest skyscrapers that they built in London. And basically they had different entrance for different people, depending on how expensive their flat was. And some people could not access the playgrounds because their flats were cheaper. That's dystopian to me. And that's happening now.
Quite, yes. Well, we're going to hear from Lynn Fraser now, and she did a creative writing MA at Anglia Ruskin University. And you mentioned your MA. What impact did that have on your writing, doing an MA?
Massive impact. So the master's I did was the one from continuing education at Cambridge University. And I did my PhD in Anglia Ruskin, and they were both really, really, well, to be honest, I'm very vague and I need deadlines to be able to write. If I just have all the time in the world, I don't get anything done. And in a way, I look for these courses because I also want to give myself a structure. So that's very important and it's very helpful. Also, I have, like I said, like a young family and so on, and a full-time job. So in order to force yourself to find a space to write, it's very good because suddenly you have a community, suddenly you have a mentor, suddenly you have guidance in things that maybe you're not very good at. Like, I might not be very good at dialogue. Well, somebody there can explain me how to do it. I know some people think that you can't learn to write, it's all natural or organic, but as everything else, it's a profession that you can learn. You can learn the ropes. And those two courses, I'm really fortunate because I learned masses of things. Yes, they're amazing courses.
Well, thank you, Mary. We'll come back and talk to you more about The Swimmers in just a moment. But let's hear from Lynn Fraser now. Lynn's debut novel, The Busy Mum's Guide to Getting Away with It, was shortlisted for the Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize. Alison Pearson said of it, comedy is seriously underrated, but it's very hard to make a reader laugh as much as Lynn Fraser does with her blissful insights into the dark side of the Parent Teachers Association. When I spoke to Lynn, I asked her what the novel was about.
It's a dark comedy about school gates politics and a mum who will do absolutely anything to make sure that her children have a better life than she had.
And you are a mum and you have been taking your child to school. How autobiographical is this?
Well, it's not at all realistic, as anyone will tell you. I would say that it's kind of an alternative life. Beverly kind of appeared like a genie from the bottle. At some point, I was having a particularly bad day on the playground. I think we were starting up a PTA and there were the usual issues with taking your child to school and school gate politics. And I decided to let off steam by writing something dark and funny. Beverly is the sort of does and says all the things that you might want to, but you really never would. So I went home and I wrote something that was mean and it made me feel much better. And it was one of those things that, you know what they say, you know, it's better to laugh than to cry. So I laughed at it and I showed it to a friend and they laughed at it. And we began sort of talking in terms of if something happened, you'd say, ah, yes, but what would Bev do? And Bev would always do something extreme. And I just started writing it, really. It's often the way with me is that I get characters in my head. So Beverly Wright became a character in my head. And I just wrote down things about Beverly, really.
And it is a ripe scenario, isn't it, for novels and for humour, the school gates and PTAs and all of that. It's a very small world.
This is the woman who would do anything, including join the PTA. You know, it's kind of, I did it and it's horrendous. And the only way to get through it is to laugh, quite frankly.
And writing humour, I mean, Alison Pearson, of all people, has praised the novel and we know she's a great humorous writer herself. Writing humour, writing comedy is quite hard.
When you're in the right mood, it comes reasonably easily, but I decided I'd write another Beverly story, and I started writing at the beginning of last year, and I had to stop because I was trying to write it during lockdown, and quite frankly, I completely lost my sense of humour. It all seemed terribly serious, and I didn't seem to be able to be funny anymore. If you get into the voice, it becomes quite easy. But if you just can't get into that zone, then I just had to give up.
And how would Beverly be coping with lockdown, do you think?
I think Beverly would probably be way on her way to being a qualified teacher by now. I think she'd be doing some kind of online PGCE and would be running schoolroom in a very serious manner. But, well, as long as, because Beverly can't cook, you see, so as long as her daughter didn't demand any banana bread, I think she'd be fine.
And you answered that very quickly. She's obviously still with you, Beverly.
She is. I mean, because we do, you know, there are situations, probably more primary school than secondary school, but I've got friends whose children more recently left primary school, and we would have conversations about things that had happened, and it would end up with, yeah, but what would Bev do? Or I had a Bev moment today. So she is, yeah, she's definitely still around.
You published this novel about a scenario that you were still perhaps going through at the time of going to the school gates. Were people looking at you sidelong, wondering if they were in the novel or not?
A little bit. I mean, although I wrote it while I was there, I mean, it's one of those stories that hung around for a long time. So I wrote a first draft and then it sat for a bit and then I edited it. So by the time it came to be published, I wasn't at the school anymore. And it's probably a good thing because you kind of amalgamate, don't you, when you come up with characters for novels, you sort of think, oh, a bit of that person, a little bit of that person, and a bit of that scenario. But I suspect that, yeah, I mean, some of the staff would probably have said to me, you know, am I the head teacher or am I the school secretary? And the answer is no. You know, yes, the role is there. And yes, there might be elements of different people in it. There's a couple of characters that people do say to me, that's so-and-so, isn't it? And I'm like, well, it might be. And there was one person who said, is that me? And I said, well, no, it's not you. Lots of people are there, but probably not in the form that they exist in the real world. But yes, it's probably quite a good thing that I wasn't at the school anymore.
One of the words used to describe yourself on Twitter handle is feminist. How much did your feminism, did those beliefs inform this writing?
I think they inform all my writing. This is very female-led as a story. But then, you know, the heroes and the villains are women. I don't tend to write romance. So the answer to solutions in my real world and fictional world is not find the handsome man and live happily ever after. It's bound to have been suggested to me at some point that a conclusion for Beverly could have been that she could have found new love. She begins the story dumped by her husband, but she doesn't end the story in a new relationship. I mean, that wasn't the point for me. One of the key elements of the story is about female friendship. So one of the things that does save Beverly from the worst of herself, in a sense, is that she finds friends. And it's those relationships that are important in the story and, you know, are important to me, not to dismiss romantic relationships completely, but they're not the core of a life story to me.
How easy was it to resist that pull towards rounding it off nicely with a romance? Because I'm sure, you know, there might have been agents or publishers who thought that's what we need at the end. That's always what happens in those scenarios.
I think I'm saved by the fact that I can't write romance. I just can't do it. I think I tried in one story. And, you know, my romantic hero was completely unbelievable. And I couldn't come up with romantic scenarios that felt credible even to me. So I'm saved by the fact that I just can't write it.
And this is a woman, I mean, Bev is a woman who wants the best for her child. And she joins the PTA and she's got all these other things going on in her life. I mean, there is a serious point in this, isn't there, that women are juggling all these different things and still trying to put their children before them and give them a better life than they had.
One of the things I struggled with the story is that I'd taken Beverly out of work. So she had a career and she was a woman who'd chosen to give up her career to bring up her children. I struggled with that because in my head, the real life scenario would be she would have a job as well. But it didn't work for the story. But I was uncomfortable with that because I think she would actually have been juggling more. I think she would have been juggling the children, the parenting, the trying to be an educator, the joining the PTA. And I think she'd have had a job as well.
What about the MA in creative writing that you did at Anglia Ruskin University? Could you have written this book without doing that MA? How much was it a product of that learning?
The main thing the MA gave me was permission to write and the confidence to try something I hadn't tried before and the time. So I'd played with writing before I did the MA. And would I have written a novel before? I probably wouldn't. I wouldn't have been brave enough to write a novel. It wasn't that I learnt how to write a novel. It was that somebody said you could write a novel. And somebody said, why don't you start a novel? I did in fact start this during the MA, but I didn't finish it. And the MA doesn't ask you to finish a novel. So I don't think I learnt to write. I think I learnt to have confidence to write.
And what are you writing at the moment? Is there anything in your notebook at the moment?
Various things in my notebook at the moment. There's half a second Bev book, just because I felt like she ought to be allowed to live the next chapter of her life. There's a completed draft of a completely different novel about witches, everyday witches, sort of about the magic of hope and friendship, I suppose. And there's also a crimey novel lurking around as well. So there's lots of nascent things that I can't seem to, in the middle of lockdown, finish.
And The Busy Mum's Guide to Getting Away with It by Lynn Fraser is published by Orion Dash. We're talking on Bookmark today to Marion Womack about her novel, The Swimmers. Marion, Lynn talking there about writing during lockdown. Isolation is a strong theme in your novel as well. I mean, the opening of the novel is quite disturbing, very striking, a pregnant woman in a pod wondering what the hell is going on.
I have felt, obviously, because during lockdown, I also gave birth. This is something that I...
Congratulations.
I just put it out there because it happened. So I had a long time. I had maternity leave. I was self-isolating because I was pregnant. And then I gave birth and my husband was there briefly with me, like happened to thousands of other women. Then he had to leave and I was alone in the hospital before and after. So you need to find resilience and you need to find strength somewhere. I'm not ashamed to say that sometimes I use writing for to find this kind of strength and as a sort of therapeutical way of life. In fact, when I don't write, I get very grumpy and I get a bit upset and so on. And yeah, I wrote about those moments of isolation in a way because I had lived through similar things. I draw a lot from my life in order to tell my stories. I think all writers do.
And you have two narrators in this book, Arlo and Pearl. Was that always going to be the case? And they switch narrations, so we sometimes see the same thing from a different perspective. Was that always going to be the case?
It was. Again, going back to Why Sargasso Sea, one thing that really struck me was exactly what you say, how you can see their perspectives on the same moments, the same scenes, and what you learn from one, what you learn from the other. You don't want to have the tunnel vision of only having one narrator, one POV. And the world seemed too big for me to give it only to Pearl. In a way, I needed somebody else there. At some point, it was growing so much. It was going to be more a choral novel with more characters having their own chapters. But I thought it felt more intimate as well to have the relationship as the main structural bone and just seeing both of them commenting on things. I didn't want to lose some of that intimacy. It's difficult to make something, write something that you don't want to be claustrophobic, but you want it to be intimate. And how, well, it's claustrophobic in some points, like when you say when she's in the pod about to give birth. But I wanted the world to retain some of that and also not to feel that you couldn't breathe in it. It's a very difficult balancing act. I'm not even sure I got it right.
Well, they're each products of their own world, aren't they? And through them, we learn about the effects of the landscape, the environment that they're living in.
And who is doing what, and what are people on the ring Arlo's case, doing to the people below and why, and whether they think they're helping or they're, they think they don't think they're helping, and how they're also lying to themselves in a way. I think when you're trying to contain climate collapse, climate change, there's so many actors that come into action, and it really is difficult to know if things are being done for our good or not for our good. And I wanted that part of that confusion as well. I think Arlo, for some of the book, think they're doing the right thing up there, and then he has a change of heart, and then he sees.
Well, let's hear your second choice of music now, which is Yerma by Estrella Morenti. Why this one?
Obviously, I needed to have some Andalusian inspiration, and I don't like flamenco massively, but I love Estrella Morenti. She's a very modern take on flamenco. This particular one ties very well with the issues of fertility and infertility that also I write about all the time, both in Los Objects and here as well in The Swimmers.
¿Por qué duerme solo pastor en mi colcha de lana?
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
It's the breakfast show that's all about Cambridge. We've got the news.
National and local.
Travel updates.
From the A14 to Milton Road and all stations to Cambridge.
The people and the places.
Plus guests in our Friday food club.
Cambridge Juice.
All the new things to do in the city.
Our daily quiz.
Oh yes, questions with Lucian.
And all request Jukebox Friday.
And don't forget the coffee.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
Here with a fresh blend weekday mornings from 7.
What's in your spare room? Christmas decorations? Maybe an old exercise bike? Could you give that room to a young person along with a fresh start? St Christopher's Fellowship is looking for people to become foster carers in Cambridgeshire to provide safe, caring homes for teenagers who need help. And because we've been working to improve young people's lives since 1870, you can trust that you're not on your own. You'll receive regular training, dedicated social worker support, and space to share experiences with other carers. It's more than a spare room, it's a brighter future. Call 0800 234 6282 or visit stchris.org.uk/fostering. St Christopher's, creating brighter futures.
Hi, Pam here. Are you tired of the same old shops? Drop into Fantasia on Mill Road near Parker's Peace. Enter our treasure cave full of fine clothing and exotic homewares. Natural materials, uplifting ambiance, mood improvement guaranteed. Perk up your wardrobe, your home, your life. Dare to shop different. Fantasia, 64 Mill Road, Cambridge. Fantasia.uk.com.
For opening times, please see fantasia.uk.com.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
We're talking on Bookmark today to Marion Womack about her book, The Swimmers. Marion, the past is another country, as they say. The past in this novel, there are references to the internet, to ancient rituals, some of which are now perceived as magic. The relationship the characters have with the past generally and with their own past, it's really interesting.
When the characters look at the past, what I was trying to do was maybe to address trauma. I think they're trying to process things. Pearl is trying to process so many things that have happened to her family, to her environment. Looking at the past is a process of trying to process in these traumatic events. And Pearl gets it wrong so often. She mixes memories with songs and with folklore and memories, realities with things she's invented or dream about. In fact, in early iterations of the novels, there was much more confusion of this, but several beta readers told me that it was too confusing. It had to be a bit more streamlined. Whereas I think that Harlow has a very set ideas of historical facts and a much more academic way of breaking down the past. What I'm trying to convey in the book is that none of them really work. You can't really believe in memories that you might be inventing, that you are creating yourself. And obviously history is not telling you the truth either. So where do we can find answers? How do we look into the future if the past is something that is waiting on us so much? Obviously all the museum and all the collecting and all addresses that, the weight of the past. It doesn't let us sometimes look into the future, look into the present to avoid having problems in the future.
And you've got these lovely fables that are scattered throughout the book as well.
This is something that I wrote actually for myself as part of the world building. And I was thinking at some point just to publish them in my website or to just have them as extra things that I could send to readers or put out there for free. But at some point, they tied very well with the story. I think they give you another perspective of what their mindset is coming from. Pearl is so confused. Pearl doesn't really know what happened. No one has told her what's happened. And she's desperately trying to find out.
We're going to hear from Elizabeth Sneed in just a moment. Now, she's talking about her guide to what happens when a relationship breaks down. And there is a love story in The Swimmers as well, a transgressive relationship, if you like, between somebody who lives in space and the Earth dweller. Was there always going to be that romantic element?
Absolutely. I was all interested in their interaction as individuals, and then at some point the characters run away with falling in love with each other. I had no control over it. And it sort of helped a lot explaining the different worlds and the different power dynamics that control the world.
Thank you, Marion. We'll come back to you in just a moment. But let's hear now from Elizabeth. Elizabeth Sneed is a family lawyer based in Cambridge. She trained as a collaborative lawyer and works alongside financial experts, mediators and counsellors to support her clients through the legal process of separation and divorce. Her guide to this process, written with Diane Room, is now in its third edition. When I spoke to Elizabeth, I asked if those going through a separation or divorce needed a self-help guide, given there are so many experts and professionals working in that field.
Yes, I really think we can. I mean, this book was first written by myself and my friend Diane. We were at law school together many years ago, and our joined frustrations were that clients were coming to see us and, you know, they didn't really understand what a solicitor was. They didn't really understand why we would work with a financial advisor, a mediator or an actuary, what those roles were, how they all meshed together. And then the equal frustration with clients saying, I didn't realise I was going to be charged for that. I could have done that myself. Or, you know, just kind of understanding how the network all fits together, really. And there's so many bits and pieces that clients, if they wish to, can do themselves. And equally, I think it's about being clear about, well, why do I need to go and see a financial advisor? Well, because they can do ABC. Why do I need an actuary? Well, because this is why. And I think if you understand how things work, then you can either choose to have the gold standard service and say to your solicitor, please do everything for me and I'll pay the bill. Or you can do the Tesco basics. You know, I need a decree absolute, or I need a children's order that confirms how the children spend time with mum and dad. I think it's just about being clear about expectation management, I suppose.
Because with the separation and divorce, there's so much to deal with, isn't there? And you've divided it, or you speak of two areas of fallout, which do seem key, the emotional fallout and the financial fallout.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing that most people forget is, you say, oh, I want to apply for a divorce, and people think about the decree absolute, but they don't always understand that together with that, you really need the court to say this is an approved financial agreement so that you have that certainty. A lot of people forget about that or aren't aware about that. But it's also the emotional baggage that goes with it. You know, I always make a point of ringing my clients when the decree absolute arrives, and half of them will cry, even though it's what they wanted, because it's the end of an era, isn't it? You know, you don't necessarily get married thinking you're going to get divorced. And the other half might say, well, I can have that glass of champagne now. But I don't think they really do. It's more just that frustration, and it's letting out the emotions. And that's why I always say to clients, let me do the legal stuff and go get help from the specialists for the emotional bits and pieces that you need, whether it be talking to your GP, talking to a counsellor. Friends and family are great, but they're also your friends and family, so they have their own agenda, and maybe they don't like your ex-partner anymore for what they've done. So sometimes talking to somebody independent, like a family consultant, can be really helpful. And yeah, you can talk to me, I don't mind, but I probably charge a lot more per hour than they do. And not all clients have a blank checkbook.
And I suppose you do see cases where people just freeze, where they just really don't want to do anything. What do you say to them in those situations?
It's really difficult because for some clients, they go around in circles for maybe a year or so while they try to get their head together. Nearly always one person's thought about a separation for at least 6 months before they do it. And then the other person is playing catch up. So you've got all the emotional stuff that goes with that. Add in a few small children and a bit of homeschooling like we're all trying to do at the moment. And you've got a perfect storm. And I think it's just a question of really listening to what the clients say. You know, when you've got little children and they're not really upset because you've given them the wrong pizza, they're upset for something else. It's the same with clients. It's active listening. Are they cross because they've just been told their home might be sold, or are they cross because actually they're really scared about how do they go and get a mortgage? They've never had to do that before. They might have to leave Cambridge to go and move to Waterbeach because they can't afford to buy a house in Cambridge anymore, or wherever they are in the country. They're not really cross because the house has got to be sold. They're frightened about what they might have to do next. And you know, family law's common sense at the end of the day most of the time, but then the emotions gets in the way, and it's just a question of listening and being aware of the whole picture.
It strikes me listening to you talk that you not only have to have legal knowledge, but you're reading people emotionally. You're treading very carefully. You're, as you say, listening to what's being said and what's not being said.
Yeah, I suppose it's that extension of when you stand at the school gate and you're watching the mums bitching away and having a moan. We all kind of do that, I think, in our personal lives. Being a family solicitor, you take those skills and take it on six gears. It's watching the body language of the clients. And it's really interesting this last year doing numerous video meetings because clients are different in their own homes. When they come to the office to see you, they're normally quite hyped up because coming to see a solicitor, if you've never done it before, is quite a big deal. But actually talking to clients in their own homes, they're more relaxed. They're in their jeans and t-shirt and I'm not necessarily in a suit. They don't quite know how to approach it sometimes. I always sort of say, look, have a drink. If you want somebody with you, that's fine. If you want to record the meeting, I don't care. Whatever way you've got to go about to get you where you need to be, that's the most important thing.
And are there any overall guiding principles that you would give to people? I mean, some people say, you know, take him or her for all they've got, or go easy, you want to be friends at the end of it. Is there a guiding principle, or does it very much depend on the situation and the people?
I think everybody's different, but you know, those people that come and say, I want to take them to the cleaners, generally I'm probably not the right solicitor for them. And I always say to people, look, if you've got children, you're parents for life. You will have grandchildren, hopefully, eventually, or a child that's going to graduate from university. If you muck this up, you're not going to be able to both go. So what do you actually want out of life? And I think it's a question of calming them down, I suppose, refocusing them on what really matters. What are their goals in life? Is it that they want to be cross with him or her forever? Fine. So that's probably not going to make for a very happy life. Or is it actually you reconcile yourself to the fact that, okay, our relationship didn't work out, but we've got numerous children together. We're going to be tied up with each other's lives for the rest of our lives. So how can we make it work? It's always difficult when you're trying to take one house and buy two because money doesn't always stretch where you need it to. It's always difficult when you've got pensions and maybe you don't understand how they work, or he's got more money than she has, or whatever. But you just have to be realistic. You might not be able to afford those two nice houses in the middle of Cambridge. You might have to move further afield. That's how life is.
So given that, Elizabeth, when it came to writing this book, how did you decide to structure it, given that there's so much information there and so many different ways that information could go?
So Diane and I brainstormed, really. So Diane is a mediator, and before she was a solicitor, she used to work for the Children's Guardian in central London, so dealt with some really horrible, tricky cases. So it kind of naturally fell to it that she did the children's stuff and wrote about mediation because that's what she knows. I wrote about the financial bits and pieces, and I'm also a collaborative lawyer, so I wrote about that. The book sort of wrote itself in a way once we decided what we were going to do. And certainly, as family have said, when they read the financial sections, it's just like I'm talking to them because that's how I wrote the book.
And I don't want to do you out of any work here, but is it possible to do all this without any legal help, without any professional help?
It's difficult. Certainly the court system is set up now that you can do an online divorce, and the new online divorce portal is really good. And if you are a vanilla divorce, it's straightforward, then yes, you can certainly do that yourself. You can certainly negotiate a financial agreement yourself as well, but the bit that struggles at the minute is the financial agreement needs to be drafted by lawyers for the court to then approve. So certainly you need input then. And I think even if you just have an initial meeting with a solicitor to understand what you need to do, if you then do the bulk of your work yourself, that's fine. That's a good way to trim your legal costs. But if you understand what you've got to do first, it's going to be a lot easier, surely. And if you are fairly amicable and if you don't mind doing the paperwork, then yes, you can do a lot yourself.
So who would this book be for then? This is for people maybe about to embark on separation or divorce or thinking about it or halfway through?
It's a bit of both. I mean, certainly one of my clients, a lovely lady called Amanda, who is cited in the previous edition, gives it to everybody that is thinking about getting divorced because she just says it's really useful. You know, if you're not a lawyer, you need to understand how this stuff works and how everything fits together. I'd say certainly, yeah, if you're thinking about separating, then have a look because there's lots of useful tips and tricks in there that you might not think about. But equally, just because you're halfway through the court process doesn't mean you can't learn anything new. Have a read. There's no law in it. It's aimed at every mum and dad at the school gate. You have to pick it up and go, okay, this is what I need to know.
And Managing Separation and Divorce by Diane Broome and Elizabeth Sneed is published by Emerald Guides. We've been speaking on Bookmark today to Marion Womack about her novel, The Swimmers, which is published by Titan Press. Well, Marion, what's next for you?
I'm writing a novel at the moment about something that intrigues me a lot, which is a very, very difficult case in Spain in which it's been proved that the Catholic Church stole babies from the early 70s till the early 2000s. At the beginning, it started with families that were not Francoist families, who were left-wing families, and it just carried on throughout the decades. There's been very little investigated, hardly any criminal prosecution. Nobody's doing anything about it. And I want to write a novel about this. But again, it's a topic that is so triggering and it's so hard. And it really is difficult for me to sit down and write it, that I have to twist it. I have to do a speculative fiction version of it. It's going to have witches and ghosts and everything you can imagine to tell this story.
A question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark as well is, what are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a book, funny enough, called Why We Swim by Bonnie Tsui. It's an essay that goes through the different ideas around swimming, whether we swim for well-being, whether we swim to build community, whether we swim for self-care or because we're competitive. It was a present that one of my PhD supervisors gave me after I handed in the PhD, I handed in The Swimmers.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music, but a heads up that our next show featured guest is Edward Parnell, talking about his book Ghostland, In Search of a Haunted Country. We'll also hear from Julian Sedgwick and Chie Kutsuwada about their collaboration on the part manga, part prose book Tsunami Girl, and Eleanor Arevalo Melville will talk about her beautiful picture book Umbrella. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Marion, which is Sawdust and Diamonds by Joanna Newsom. Why this one?
Joanna Newsom is my absolute favourite singer. I've seen her live more than any other artist. I follow her all over the UK and Spain. She's absolutely amazing live. So this album is actually based on some folklore from Brittany about a city that is on the sea. And it's got a lot of sea elements and sea metaphors. And this particular song accompanied me a lot while I was writing The Swimmers.
From the top of the flight of the wide white stairs, through the rest of my life, do you wait for me there? There's a bell in my ears, there's the wide white roar. Drop a bell down the stairs, hear it fall forevermore. Hear it fall forevermore. Drop.